Well, my name is Werner Jensen, and I first came to Holden Village, actually, when I was, 22 years old, in 1961. I think that I was 22. I had graduated from Purdue University and in aeronautical engineering and was working with Boeing, and actually through a notice in the bulletin in our church that they were inviting people up to attend the dedication of the diesel electric plants, and which was installed in 61, and I noticed over in the village center they had it at 62, which is wrong because it was dedicated in 61, I know that. And anyway, that's how I first got acquainted with Holden, and then was intrigued with what was going on here, and volunteered for some committees in Seattle. They were asking for people in the Seattle area to help out on various committees. And then in 1963, I took a leave of absence from Boeing and came up here for 3 months on the volunteer staff, and actually was listed as the kitchen coordinator, and I really can't remember what I did as kitchen coordinator. But that was my introduction to Holden. And in 1963, then in the fall of 1963, I was asked if I was interested in being the general manager of Holden Village. And let's see, I guess I was 24 at the time, and had no idea what the general manager of Holden Village would do, but maybe some of you remember Vern Reithy, who was the chairman of the board at that time, and he was professor of law at the University of Washington Law School, and I know I talked to him, and he was the one that asked me, and I said, well, I guess if you have confidence that I can do it, I'll give it a try. And Rudy Edmund, who is another old-timer that some of you, if you were up here some years ago, he also encouraged me to take it, so I decided to leave a short engineering career and come up here as general manager, which I did then in 63 with the really the intent of staying a few years and then going back to Boeing, which I never did. So in 1983, I retired from here. Actually, I stayed one more year as a consultant, although we'd moved to Leavenworth in the fall of 83. And so actually was involved with Holden, until 1984 through 84. So that was my introduction to Holden and how I got involved. Our son Jeff is with me tonight, and he was born in Chelan, but rode up on behind the snowmobile when he was 6 days old. And our daughter Christy was born in 1970. Jeff was in 73, I think. And Jeff was up here, 10 years basically of his life, and started school here. It's the only school he knew up until, I guess, the fourth grade when we moved to Leavenworth. Christy, our daughter, who now lives in Puyallup with her family, her husband is Jeff, and they have two daughters, Kayla and Chloe. And son Jeff, his spouse is Joanne, and they live in Leavenworth or Krashaston, so that they're close by now. And Jeff actually flies for Horizon, so if you take any Horizon flights, you might be flying with Jeff. He's a good pilot. So that sort of indicates the how I got involved initially, and I think I mentioned I was up here a few weeks ago and did I think three sessions, so some of this may be repetitive, but I guess it doesn't make any difference because it's being recorded and you can listen to the others if you like. It's really been fun to share some of the stories, and it's amazing the amount of information and stories that have been generated by a lot of people up here, and even, of course, since 83, there's even a lot more stories. But the one thing that hit me today, just in the orientation again, was how Holden is now listed as a Lutheran ministry, which to me, when I saw that, I guess it didn't really bother me, but I took note of it because I know all the years that I was here, we were sort of careful to say that Holden Village was a religious cultural community that was associated with the Lutheran Church, but actually Holden Village Incorporated is a is an independent nonprofit corporation in the state of Washington, and the corporation, in a sense, has nothing to do with the Lutheran Church, unless that's changed. Maybe it's changed in recent years, but I doubt it. So, but anyway, I mean, it's not that I would object to having Holden a Lutheran ministry, but it's just that during the years that we were here, it seemed like it was more of a open ecumenic. Well, it still is, but again, we didn't identify it as a Lutheran ministry. We used the Lutheran Book of Worship. We used the Lutheran services. We, you know, most of the people that were here were associated with the Lutheran Church. So, you know, that hasn't changed any. But it was really a you know, sort of an open ecumenical ministry, and part of it in those days was that, you know, we'd have a lot of people coming up to the village, and maybe one spouse was very much involved in the church, and the other spouse didn't want anything to do with the church. And they could come up here, and they could feel comfortable, even though we had the discipline of worship with the matins and the vespers and so forth, that there was never any imposition of a doctrine or theology. I mean, a lot of things were discussed here, and it was very open. And so it was. I often referred to it as a cheap way to get a college education without taking tests. And we also, maybe some of you are familiar with the Aspen Institute, which is a very expensive place. I've never been to the Institute, but you know, each summer they meet there, and some of the, you know, top people from, I think, all over the world gather there to have discussions and lectures and so forth. In those early years, we would sometimes have professors who were coming out to the Aspen Institute and paid big bucks to go there, and then they would travel the rest of the distance to Holden Village on their own dollar and spend maybe 3 or 4 weeks here on faculty. So we used to call this the poor man's Aspen. And it really, really is the truth, because I think our lectures were just as good as the Aspen lectures, but we didn't have quite the notoriety of that the Aspen Institute did. But again, eventually I think the other three sessions that I did, they'll be, you know, on the archives, and you can listen to them online and so forth. And some of this will be repeated and some of them won't. But one of the things that I think is interesting is just how some of the things that now are at Holden, you know, got started. And you know, in a sense, there wasn't a lot of planning. In other words, we didn't have a planning committee. You know, that's necessary now for anything, and I know even Holden has a lot of planning committees going now for various things. In those days, it was sort of, you know, we were glad to operate from day to day, and if somebody got an idea and it was, you know, seemed like it was practical to try it, we tried it. And one of the things that, you know, sitting outside and looking up at the hot tub or the jacuzzi, again, we didn't have any grand design saying that, you know, for the health of the community, we needed a therapy pool or a hot tub. How that came about was that Carol Henderly and I were in Seattle for a meeting, and we stayed at, I think it was called the Loyal Inn. It was not too far from the Seattle Center, and this was probably in the, 68, 67 in there, and they had a therapy pool, you know, in the motel, and Carol really enjoyed it, and he says, we've got to have one of these for Holden. And so when we came back, I contacted, I think it was one of the outfits in Wenatchee, Central Washington Water, because they dealt with pools, and I went down there and said, you know, can we get some plans for a therapy pool? And, you know, they said, we don't have any. I mean, this was back in the days when therapy pools weren't a dime a dozen. You know, you couldn't buy them, and very few homes had them. And so the next time I went to Seattle, I went back to the Loyal Inn, and I measured on myself. I sat in there and said, well, the seats, when I'm sitting on the seat, the water came up to about here. And I measured exterior of the pool, and I went back to Central Washington Water and said, well, do you have the equipment? They said, yeah, we can order the equipment from Jacuzzi, but, you know, we don't have any plans. You know, we can help you plumb it, but that's all. So we basically, you know, built the Jacuzzi from, you know, taking measurements. and that's basically how it came about. And again, you know, in those early days, the village really didn't have much money. And in fact, it had no money. And so when we wanted to do something like the therapy pool, it was generally, well, who might be willing to make a donation? And Fern Olson, who was one of the saints of Holden in those early years, she lived in Spokane and was listed as the head housekeeper, but she was much more than that up here over many years, 10, 12 years. Anyway, she had a lot of contacts in Spokane and knew the manager of, I think it was the JCPenney store in Spokane, and she contacted them and said, you know, they want a therapy pool up at Holden, can you make a donation? And I think he gave either $2,500 or $5,000, which was a lot of money in those days. And so that was basically, you know, how we got the therapy pool. And that was sort of indicative of, you know, a lot of things that went on up here. It was, again, not as I say, it wasn't a grand plan of what was going on, but it was, you know, people would come up with ideas, and if there was any chance that we could do them, then we gave them a try. The Tate Ministry, which I guess now is called the I'm not sure what it's called, it's involved with the media center. but actually I started that way early with a reel-to-reel recorder that I got from a pawn shop. And I bought it for a few bucks and brought it up here because I was so impressed with the lectures that were going on, and thought that, you know, these really should be saved. And so in the first couple of years, I just went around amongst other things, and I would set up the recorder when somebody was giving a lecture, and then I'd go back and work in the office, and I'd go down and turn it off, and so that's really how it got started. And then when it was obvious that there was a function for the Tate Ministry, and in those years, again, it was the idea that people, you know, would come up here and they would get really inspired by what they were hearing, that we even then set up listening stations. Maybe some of you were here years ago, remember that, listening stations on the front of each lodge, and we had tapes from the current year plus the previous year, and people could listen with earphones sitting on the front of each lodge. And, you know, just to try to, we didn't, of course, the internet wasn't available at that time. And so, you know, those were the type of things that got started. And there was a couple from, actually, they were from Texas Lutheran College, Don and Dottie Rosenauer, that came up on volunteer staff. And they were the ones that first organized the Tate Ministry. They spent a lot of time in sort of coming up with a concept for the Tate Ministry. And then later, Sig Schrader, who spent quite a number of years at Holden, operated the Tate Ministry. But at that time, it was all, you know, cassettes, and again, we didn't have the luxury of the internet to publicize these. So it's really great now that Holden has this option, that you can go on the website and go into the archives and, you know, put in a name of a lecture, and I'm not sure if you put in the name of a particular subject what will come up, but I know the lecturer, you can actually hear tapes from, I think, way back. I'm not sure how long they've been put on. Another thing that the Holden Bell, which has been here for a long time and calls people to worship, to dinner or to meals and to lectures and so forth, that was actually Gil Berg, who was the first volunteer, basically manager and director of Holden. He owned a fuel oil business in Ballard, and he was really the one that, to a great extent, allowed Holden to get started, because he had some personal means, and he had time because he was semi-retired from his fuel business. And so he spent a lot of time coming back and forth and organizing some of the early, even cleanup crews and so forth. And really, he was the one that, you know, for the first several years, really got things going. Well, he had a friend that I think was an executive with Burlington Northern, and in the late 50s and early 60s, they were, you know, scrapping out a lot of the old steam engines, and these bells were really valuable. I mean, people wanted to get a hold of one. Fortunately, this executive responded to Gil's request, and because I think Gil had the concept that one should be up here, and I know it sat in a warehouse for 3 or 4 years before it was actually shipped up here, and then it was put in pretty much the same location it is. But it actually, you know, came from, you know, Great Northern locomotive that probably went between here and Minneapolis for many years, as a lot of people have come from Minneapolis. So it's the other thing that the Alpenhorn that's in the dining hall that hangs up there, that was carved by Carl Wiesen, who just died, I think, 2 years ago, maybe it was this last year. And in the early years, starting, I think it was 1959 or 60, that there was a group of, we call them the Swiss loggers, because they were actually from Switzerland, so it was appropriate to call them Swiss loggers, but they used what they called a highline logging operation. So instead of building roads up the side of the mountain, they strung a cable to a deadhead tree, you know, way up the mountain, and then they had a motorized a motor, and they would actually lift the logs out of the forest and then swing them down this cable and bring them down to a landing where they loaded them on a logging truck and then took them down the down to the lake and dumped them in the lake, and then a barge would take them down to a mill that used to be in Mass, and it's no longer there. But they were in here for 10 years operating their logging outfit in the valley, and you know, you couldn't really tell they had logged because they were selectively picking trees. And then they again weren't building roads into the area. They were swinging the, you know, the logs down the hole. So it was a very, you know, environmentally, ecologically great logging system. And it was developed actually by Carl Wiesen's uncle in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And they were up here for those 10 years and became very good friends of Holden. And at one point he carved this Alpenhorn and presented it to Holden as a gift. I think most of the time they came up here, it was the snack bar that they were interested in. They loved it. but they were also invited to, you know, a lot of the programs and entertainment that we had up here. I mean, they were a part of the community, even though they lived in Lucerne for those 10 years. Every summer they were here. And it was really because of the Wiesen logging that the upper diversion dam for the hydro plant was able to get built, because at that point, this was the 1964 is when we finished and put online the first hydro plant, the one that's existing. But that was using the diversion dam that was used by the mine for their domestic water supply, so that there was only about a 900-foot head. And these units would only put out a fraction of the power at that vertical head. So we extended the pipeline and added, I think it was 2,000 feet of pipe, and up further up the mountains. Well, Wiesen Logging actually built that road for us. They volunteered their equipment and their time. They would come after work or weekends if they were in the valley, and they built that road for us. So it was a great community experience to have the Wiesen Logging in here and participate. In those early years, again, we didn't have people that were really familiar with logging procedures and safety and so forth. So if we had a danger tree around the village, it was always, we'd call Carl or his cousin, and they would come up and they would fall trees for us. I mean, anything that we needed, as long as it fit into their work schedule, they were up here and would help us. So Holden, got started by the help of a good many people, and we didn't have any money in those days. In fact, the truck that's the international truck, I think it's the 1961 truck that is sitting down there by the, I think that is the original pick, or the original flatbed truck, and that was the first vehicle really that Holden had. And Gil Berg loaned Holden, I think it was $1,200 or $1,500, because Holden didn't have a bank account, it didn't have any money to buy anything, and that was really the only transportation that, we had. In 1961, when I came up here, we all rode on the back of that truck. There were 32 people that came up late that day. And, you know, all the luggage was unloaded. We hopped on the back of that truck, and then Gil Berg drove it up here, and that was really the only transportation there was. And some of you from Seattle probably remember Stan Borison. He was on Channel 5. He was a Norwegian, I don't know what you'd call it.
Kid show.
Yeah. And it was a great show. Anyway, he was the entertainment that weekend when we dedicated the diesel electric plants. Pastor Brown from Finney Ridge Lutheran was the pastor, because you always have to have a pastor to dedicate something. And, so Pastor Brown came up as the pastor, and then Stan Borison was the entertainment. And so that was, again, my introduction to Holden. But it was that truck that allowed, you know, all those early people to come up. And then finally, there were others. There was a very generous family in Wilbur, Washington, which is between here and Spokane. And their names were shuffled. Jerry was the son, and Lou was the father. And they were very generous to Holden. And in fact, they found the hydroelectric plants that now are still in operation. They found them at in a warehouse over in Idaho that had been a part of an irrigation system, and the old units had been sitting in the warehouse for 20 years, and they bought all that equipment for $1,500 and then gave it to Holden, and then, you know, sent it up lake, and then we started the process of putting in the hydro plant. So by the time we finished the hydro plant, we had $39,000 into it, and you know, it was one of those unbelievable things that basically a volunteer crew of people. We had one talented person on the crew, Henry Schwecke, who was from Wenatchee, and he worked with Seattle City Light, I think it was, at the Cedar Falls Hydro Project for many years. So he was experienced operator, and he was a mechanic himself, and he had his own lathe equipment in his little shop in Wenatchee. So a lot of the parts of the hydro that we got free needed repairs. I mean, he had to rebuild some things. He had to rewire stuff, and he did all of that. And so we were very fortunate. The rest of the work was done by volunteers up here, and it was. I know one time I was in Seattle to give some programs on Holden, and there was a contractor there. And when I told him that we did this basically with volunteer labor, he said, "That's impossible. You know, you can't do that." And I said, "Well, I guess we didn't know that. We just." And that again was sort of indicative. A lot of the things that we got started up here is that, you know, there were people that were willing to do things and try, and usually somebody showed up that had some experience, and so, you know, it was just a very interesting thing that if we were going to do something, eventually that summer somebody showed up that had some interest or willingness to do it. In the early years, there was a big junkyard up around the mill, and that was really the source of, you know, a lot of artwork. In fact, it was also sort of our hardware store, because if we needed something down here, even in plumbing, you know, we'd go up there and go through all the junk piles and so forth, and we'd usually find something that we could salvage off of that, bring it down here, and, you know, put it into plumbing systems and so forth. And Dan Erlander, who many of you know, that has been up here many times on teaching staff, he did a lot of photography, and one of the programs he put together was the junkyard, and you know, the artistic nature of junk, basically. And you know, like a lot of the things that have happened up here in terms of the crafts and arts, again, didn't start by plan, but by, in a sense, chance, or somebody, you know, was interested in something like the art welding. That was really started because we had a junkyard, and it didn't cost anything to go up and find some metal and start welding it together. And Terry Saturn, who was up here as a volunteer, he did the dancing servant, which is, became sort of a symbol of Holden in those early years. And that was, I think, he sort of started the arc welding. And after that, you know, many people showed up, and they even had, you know, he and other people would go up there and show people how to weld sufficiently well to, you know, to do artwork. Now, I know that OSHA would never have approved any of that, but I guess if you call it art, maybe OSHA doesn't have jurisdiction. but it's again, so many people got started with, especially the young people that were coming to the village, got started in these various fields just because they had the opportunity here, and nobody told them they had to do it in a certain way, or that they couldn't do it, or that, you know, they should wait until they went to school to do it. They just did it, you know, and those that had a knack for it succeeded and went on, and, you know, others that didn't like it, you know, went, you know, in another direction. So that was part of the miracle of Holden in those years, is that you know, so many people had a chance to explore, what they might be doing. And the other thing that was, I think, so marvelous about Holden is that it became a place of refuge, and it probably still is. But in those days, you know, we would have, you know, it was in the turbulent 60s and 70s, and you know, a lot of kids were, young adults were, you know, mad at their parents, they were mad at the church, they were mad at the world, and they were just mad. And, you know, Holden became a place of refuge for a lot of people that needed to get away. And, you know, I would get a letter from a pastor or a seminary professor or another person, and they would beg us, you know, will you take our son or daughter that we think that, you know, she or he is, we're losing them, both from our family as well as from the church. And, you know, we always took, I mean, we didn't have a limit to our staff. Usually we could always use more. And so if we got a letter or a request, we always took them. We never asked questions. We didn't ask them, you know, what problems they had been in or anything like that. It was that Holden was always open to the people that needed help. And so I think that over the years, that Holden has become that type of a refuge for many, many people. And and in some ways, you know, even Wes Preeb, who, you know, wrote the letters and really, you know, is responsible for allowing Holden to get into, you know, the hands of the church and so forth, that it was a refuge for him. You know, a lot of stories are told of Wes, and, you know, many of them are in terms of humor, but he was also, I think, a person who was hurting. He was a very lonely person, and I think that, I mean, I have no idea what would have happened to Wes if it wouldn't have been for Holden, because Holden did become his home. And, you know, same way with Carol Hinderly. He was a marvelous person and theologian, but Carol also had problems, and he had problems, you know, in the church. He had, you know, problems that he was dealing with, and yet Holden became a refuge for him, and in a sense, you know, in a miraculous way, you know, it seemed like people would show up that needed Holden as well as Holden needed them. And, you know, so that's how really Holden got started. And it continues to be a refuge for people. And it's just a marvelous thing how over the years that I think so much healing has taken place here. There's also been a lot of hurt here. And I think that's the part of Holden that doesn't get talked about too much, is that, you know, Holden is a real place. It's not a fantasy. It's not a Shangri-La. But people have been hurt here too, and you know, that I think even the board at times has glossed over that and tried to protect Holden from, you know, some of the negatives of Holden, and you know, whether that'll ever come out, I don't know, because, you know, we tend to, in the church, you know, we tend to, you know, things happen and we tend to not talk about them. And Holden, in a sense, is like that too, that it's a real place that has had hurts, and people have been hurt here, you know, we don't like to talk about those aspects because Holden is so special to so many people. Another aspect of the refuge is that I think it was in the early 70s that there was a judge from Whitman County that came up here, and he asked me if there was any chance that we could start a group home for boys. That he said that in his courtroom that so many of the cases that he dealt with were young boys that were taken away from their home situation, and the only place that they could go was, you know, some of the state-sponsored group homes, which were just financially the only way that they could operate would be if there was maybe 20 or 25 boys in the group home. And that in itself, you know, causes problems if you put people that are, you know, hurting or in trouble to put them in that type of setting. And he said if there was only a place where there could be maybe six boys, and so we started investigating it and actually started a group home. And I think it operated for about 7 years. And Holden wasn't dependent upon the money which we got from the state, and because we never could have operated with six boys. But it was really great to see what happened with that situation, because for the first time, I think many of these boys would come into a situation where they didn't have the law constantly at their doorstep. I mean, you know, once you get into trouble as a youth, you know, you're known as a troublemaker, and if something happens in the town, the first place that the sheriff goes is to your house. Now, I don't know that personally. That didn't happen to me or Jasper. But we would, it was true. They would come up here, and for the first time maybe in their lives, they saw a community that was entirely different than they'd ever known. They saw, you know, families that were actually getting along together. You know, they saw people having fun without getting into trouble. And so there are still, every once in a while, I run into some of the people in Wenatchee that were part of that group home that, you know, one of them went on to electronics school and is, you know, last I heard he was repairing transmitters, you know, like for NPR and some of the radio stations around the area. There was another boy that went into electronics and actually invented some testing equipment for the fruit industry, and he had his own little business going. And, you know, it's also involved in the peace movement. He has his own website, and you know, so not all of the boys, you know, had a breakthrough here by any means. Again, Holden is a real place. I know one of the boys left here, and I think several months later murdered somebody and went to, you know, he's probably still in Princeton, either in Walla Walla or I don't know where. But another young lad that had a problem with theft, we didn't know it at first, but we started noticing that in the store that all kinds of strange things were missing, you know, shampoo, batteries, you know, I mean, it made no sense, but we sort of got on to that this young kid was, maybe had a theft problem, so we started going up to his room about every other week, and there he'd have cases of batteries, cases of shampoo, and we'd take him back down and we'd talk to him and tell him, you know, you can't do this, that... You know, and you know, I don't know if he ever got over the addiction, but, you know, we never had a police for him to relate to. And hopefully that he saw something here that maybe changed his life. And I think that's what happens to a lot of people that come here is that, you know, they either hear something, they see something, they get inspired to, you know, look at themselves in a different way. So and that really, because of the group home, is how the Holden School got started. The state said, well, if you're going to have boys up there, you know, you have to provide an education for them. So I went down to the Chelan Public School System in Chelan, and Cecil West was the superintendent of schools at that time, and he was a member of the Lutheran Church there, so he was familiar with Holden. Very nice, very cooperative, and, you know, I said, we need a school, and he said, okay. And I said, we're willing to provide teachers for the school at no cost to the district if you'll accredit the education that these boys would be getting. Because at that point, we still had many more volunteers, you know, wanting to come up here than we could accommodate. And right at that time, in fact, Bev Cagle, who's now living in Leavenworth, Cagle is her married name. I don't remember what her maiden name was. But anyway, she was up here on the volunteer staff. It was a certified teacher. And said, I'd be willing to stay as a volunteer. And the first year she actually did. She volunteered her time as the full-time teacher for the Holden School, which allowed the group home to get started, which also allowed professors from various colleges and universities to come up here on sabbatical. That's how the sabbatical program got started, because again, without a school system going, then those other factors wouldn't fit in. So it was in a sense just luck that the judge from Whitman County wanted a group home, which then allowed the school, which allowed other things to happen up here. And but after the second year, then the teachers union in Chelan said, well, maybe it was the state, I don't know. But anyway, they said, well, if you're going to have a school up at Holden, then the hiring process has to be the same as any school, that you have to open it up to anybody to apply for those positions, and they have to be paid the standard state rate and so forth. So we didn't know what was going to happen, but Chelan District wanted to go ahead with it. And one of the reasons that it worked out was just strictly a financial one, that in the state of Washington, I don't know about some of the other states, they had what they called remote necessary schools. Stehekin was one of those. Holden would become one. Actually, Leavenworth was one at the time. I think there's just a very few left in the state. And the state had this system where they would pay a district three times the amount for each student based on remote and necessary school needs. And and so instead of, I can't remember the rates at that time, but let's say that Chelan was getting $3,000 per pupil from the state of Washington. For the Holden School, they would get $9,000 per student. And that certainly allowed the cost of it to be covered. In fact, Chelan got into problems, and I think they were sued for a lot of money in some later years, because it turned out that they weren't spending all the money being received from the Holden School on the Holden education system, and the state said that's you can't use that money to bolster the education in Chelan. It's got to be up here. So they ended up, the Chelan School District ended up paying, I think it was several million dollars back to the state because of this system up here. But it kept going, and of course it's expanded now. And it's during the mine years, the school only went from grades, I think kindergarten or first grade, up to eighth grade. And then the miners, when the student got to be going into the high school or ninth year, they either boarded them out in Chelan or Wenatchee, or the people left the mine and moved down lake. And both of those things happened, that some families had relatives in Chelan or Wenatchee, and their kids would board out with relatives or friends. And Stehekin only has school up to the eighth grade. Holden here now has, when we started it, we just set it up for, because again with the group home, they were all in high school, so we had to have high school. So a student actually could come here and go through all 12 grades. Jeff went, the third grade, you finished the third grade, and when we moved down to Leavenworth, and our daughter Christy, she had finished the seventh grade. I think she went into the eighth grade in Leavenworth. So their first schooling was up here, and it was a marvelous schooling system, because not only did we have a teacher that was hired, but we also had volunteers in the community that were up here on sabbatical. I remember Christy was taking math in the fifth grade from a PhD that was teaching math at one of the colleges or universities someplace, I don't remember specifically, but they were volunteering their time, so it was almost a one-on-one situation for the students here at that time. And it was a marvelous system. And when the school had a school play, it wasn't the kids that put on the play, it was the entire community that was in the play. And so the kids were relating to adults more than, or as much as they were to their, their fellow students. And I think that both of our kids, there were oftentimes, they were the only one in a particular class. And it was a very individualized, wonderful educational system. There were, in those early years, there was a drug problem all over the country, and again, Holden was not immune from that. We knew that marijuana was being used up here at times, and of course, we had rules against it, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't being used. I mean, even some faculty were using it a couple of the summers. And, you know, it was dealt with as well as it could be, but the winter community was potentially more of a problem because it is isolated. And one time I know that I was down lake, and somebody came up to me and said, you know, you've got a major drug problem at Holden. You know, it's being bought and sold. Marijuana and other drugs are being bought and sold up here. And I said, well, I don't think that's true, but, you know, we'll do what we can to investigate it. And I actually went down to the Sheriff's Department in Wenatchee, and I said, you know, what can we do? Is there any suggestion you have? And, you know, they knew a little bit about Holden and our volunteer staff and so forth. And he said, well, we have a young couple that works undercover for us on drug problems or investigation. And if it's okay, we'll just send them up to be on the volunteer staff. And, you know, he said that very quickly, I mean, they're trained, you know, to know what's going on, and very quickly they can tell what, you know, what kind of problem you had. So, you know, the staff didn't know that this was happening. I was the only one that knew. Actually, the sheriff delivered them up lake with their own boat, and I went down and picked them up. And this young couple had a small child, I think, you know, like, you know, maybe 1 or 2 years old. And so they came up here, and they were on staff for, I think we told them that they would have to be a minimum of 3 weeks because that was our rule. But after 2 weeks, they came to me and they said, you know, you don't have a problem up here. There's a little bit of marijuana being used, but he said it's so insignificant that, you know, compared with other places, don't worry about it. So after 2 weeks, they actually left because they just said there's nothing that, I mean, we can stay here for 3 weeks, we'd love to do it, but, you know, you don't have a problem. So, but again, you know, the Holden is and was a real place, and it had real problems that, you know, we dealt with in ways that we could do it. And Holden was also, you know, trying to be a part of, you know, the larger, you know, picture. And we had sort of a unique situation here. In the early years, you know, it became evident that we had an avalanche problem around here. I mean, before we came up here, the first winter we stayed here was in 1966, and there were just three of us that stayed the entire winter, and a few more came in and out. And, you know, we had no knowledge of avalanches and mountain weather and the unique situation that we were in. It became evident that, you know, we might be in a rather harsh situation up here. And especially when, you know, avalanches would occur on the road, and we didn't have any equipment to remove an avalanche. The only thing we could do would be to get a shovel, go down the road, and we had, the first winter we were up here, we had a snow track, which was a Swedish-built snowmobile that had a VW engine in it. And it had a rather strange steering mechanism on it, which wasn't like a Caterpillar where you'd hit a lever and it would put a brake on. It was what they called a variator, and it changed the speed of each track. And that wasn't a very positive, you know, change. I mean, it would work great, but it had some limitations. But we'd have to go down the road, and with a shovel, you know, we'd go down there and we'd make a ramp over, you know, on both sides of an avalanche, and we'd go over the top of it. We'd flatten the, you know, and as the winter progressed and the, you know, it started to melt, we'd have to go down and, you know, sometimes add snow to some areas, take snow off from other areas. I mean, it was lucky that we survived. we also, I talked to the Forest Service, and I said you know, is there any way we can learn more about avalanches? And right at that time, and this was again in probably 67, 68, they were just starting for the first time, they had the first Forest Service sponsored avalanche school for their own personnel down at Crystal Mountain. They said, you know, we'd invite you to go down. I mean, it was at our own dollar, but they said, this is only for Forest Service personnel, but they would invite us to go down. So I went down and attended that first avalanche school, and you know, really learned a lot that we didn't know. And also got acquainted with Ed LaChapelle, Dr. LaChapelle, who was at the University of Washington. He was sort of the world expert on glaciers, and avalanche dangers were just starting to become a you know, really in the news at that time because of the ski areas were really expanding. And we actually invited him to come up out here on staff then, which he did. And it so happened that his son, I think his son was Randy, actually ended up being on the volunteer staff and one of those that learned arc welding and other forms of art, and I think now is a professional artist and has a studio in Seattle, the last I heard. So again, you know, how all these things happen, it's just a marvelous thing. But also the one group, and I might have been a government group in Seattle, was starting an avalanche reporting station system, because at that time, prior to that time, you know, the ski areas were on their own. You know, they had to determine whether it was a danger to allow skiers to be up or not, and they finally decided that there's got to be some coordinated effort. Well, we had been sending in weather reports, you know, each month with the little weather station here, and somehow I guess they heard that we had I'd gotten a ham radio, an amateur radio license in the mid-70s, just to have communication out of here, and so they asked if I wouldn't send down a report every morning as to the temperature. I can't remember the temperature and the snow depth and how much snow, the new snow, and maybe even humidity, I don't recall. But for several years, every single morning during the winter, and I think we were the only remote station sending out information at that time. And so this is one way that we really became involved in you know, sort of the larger picture, even in the weather reporting in the state of Washington and the Northwest. And one interesting thing, Fritz Norstedt, when he was interim director here, I think in 76, 77, that again we didn't have any caterpillars or anything to remove avalanches. So it was really you know, you never knew whether the snowmobile coming up from the lake would even arrive here, you know, because it might get stuck on one side of an avalanche. And one time Fritz was coming back, he and his wife Gertrude, there was a larger group, probably of, you know, maybe 15 people that were in two snowmobiles, and they got stuck on one side of an avalanche, and somebody walked into the village to report it. So it took us, you know, several hours to get people together and go down with another snowmobile and start shoveling the avalanche so we'd get those. It so happened that Fritz had gotten a chafing dish, I think, for a gift for his wife. And Fritz being Fritz, I mean, he always could take a serious situation and make it into a celebration. And so he got this chafing dish out, and of course, groceries were coming up with the snowmobiles, and there were cases of eggs and, you know, other things. And so he proceeded to start a little fire, and with his chafing dish and eggs, he had scrambled eggs, and I don't remember what all. When we got down there and they started working on the avalanche, everybody was celebrating with, you know, having, they weren't hungry at all from. But there was one time, and it was the only time it happened while I was up here, that we were actually cut off from the outside world for 7 days. Mm-hmm. That it was one of those winters where we would continuously get so much snow, and then there would be rain, more snow, rain, and so forth. And one avalanche after another between here and Lucerne. And we would get, you know, shovel through one and get down to the next one and have to come back. And, I mean, it would be, you know, dark, and they'd go down the next day. And by that time, sometimes another avalanche would have slid. And it finally, after 7 days, we got down to Lucerne for the first time. And the only time that we were really cut off. We did have the communications with the ham radio, so we could notify people, you know, that we were okay. But it was one of the things in those years that you know, we really didn't have a lot of communication. We did have internet. We didn't have any, you know, satellite telephones or anything like that. We were totally dependent on a sheriff's radio that got into Stehekin, and then the ham radio that I operated, you know, just again as a hobby as well as for safety and for interest. So I don't know how far we're getting, there were one interesting thing. I mean, this is mean, it's not chronological, so that, I mean, none of these things fit into a timeframe, but one of the interesting things was before Fields Point was built, you know, where you park today, that everybody parked along the road at 25 Mile Creek, and it was, you just parked along the road, basically, and the commercial boat would come up to the dock, and you'd hop on, and you know, sometimes the cars would be parked way up the hill on the road, and then, you know, finally the Forest Service and the Park Service decided they needed a good parking situation. But one time I went down the lake in our own boat, as I did almost every week during the summer, to pick up supplies or whatever, and I got out of the boat and I was starting to walk up to get our car, and I noticed there was this basically pile of metal that was between two other cars, and it was wet all around it, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. That, you know, the pile of metal was maybe a foot and a half high, and I went down to the ranger station. At that time there was a Forest Service ranger station down at 25 Mile Creek, and I asked the ranger, and he sort of chuckled, and he said, well, he said, you know, there was a fire up 25 Mile Creek, and there was a helicopter that was ferrying water, you know, from the lake. They would dip out of the lake and take it up to the fire, and one of these big water bags that, you know, full of water, I don't know how many thousand pound it weighed, and the bucket got loose, and it fell on this car, and it, I mean, it was a dead shot on this one vehicle. Didn't hurt the one in front and back, and just hit the one. And there was, I mean, it was hardly identifiable. And the ranger said the only thing that we found that looked like it might be salvageable was a radio. So we took the radio out and put it in the ranger station. And when I went back up to the village, then I notified the people, and, you know, and they, I mean, they were good-natured about it, and they said, well, it's interesting, because the only thing that didn't work on that car was the radio. that was a VW Rabbit. They'd gotten it used. They were a family from Spokane. And so they sent in a story at that point. I don't know if VW still does it, but they had a little magazine that VW put out for all VW owners. And so they sent this article in. And it so happened that the helicopter pilot was named Roy Rogers. His name was actually Roy Rogers. So the article was, Roy Rogers Shoots Rabbit. And going through some boxes that I had just the other day, I actually found the page out of that magazine, which will end up in the museum here at some point, but the story about Roy Rogers shooting the rabbit. So another thing that, in fact, I think that Chuck mentioned that I might mention was on the Pigeon Project. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't to send messages anyplace, but Leo Bustead, who is, you know, was really a world renowned scientist, and at the time he was up here to a great extent, was the head of the School of Veterinary Medicine at Washington State University, and he was also the chairman of our science committee, and he was always interested in getting pets and people together. In fact, he started an organization, the Delta Society, which is Pets People Partnership. And so one of the ideas he had, he was actually the one that changed the law in the country so that pets were allowed in nursing homes and even hospitals. And he helped write that law. And Tom Foley, who was the House, what was he?
Speaker of the House.
Our Speaker of the House at that time, was a good friend of Leo Bustead's. And so when this law was passed, Leo went back for the signature. But anyway, his idea was that pigeons might be a good hobby and a pet for people in retirement centers and even nursing homes. To, you know, they could send pigeons from one nursing home to the other nursing home or something, you know. And just as a, so he said that, I think Holden ought to test that out and see if it works. And so Leo had friends in every field. And he said, I can get you some baby pigeons, and I'll get you some eggs, because there's some people that think that the eggs have to be hatched at the site before the pigeons will return to that area. So the first pigeon trials we did was, we used the garage in Chalet 1 which I think now, did you say that it had paint in it or something? Anyway, that was our first pigeon hutch. And we started raising pigeons there, and then the A-frame, which is in back of sort of Lodge 1 and the, no, Lodge, yeah, Lodge 1 in the hospital up there, there's an A-frame. That was actually the latest model of the pigeon hut that we had, because the one thing that we found out was that the weasels in the area love pigeons, and so we attempted to make that A-frame weasel-proof, and we had, I think we had, I think like 20 pigeons up there at one point, and it was really beautiful to see. It was great educational thing for the village too, because very few people, I think on the East Coast, even in some of the bigger cities, there's more people that are into pigeons as far as hobbies. Out here, they not so much, but you know, we would release the pigeons and you'd always let them out of the cages before you fed them, and they would fly up in a flock, and they would always make three circles every single time. They'd go up, make three circles, and they would fly off someplace, and then they would come back, you know, for the meal. And so after a while, then when I went down to 25 Mile with my boat, I would take a cage of maybe three or four pigeons with me, and you know, when I released them down at 25 Mile, I would mark down the time, and sure enough, they would go out of the cage. They would make three circles in the air, and they would head not up the lake, but over First Creek or over 25 Mile Creek, and sort of in the northwest direction. And the first time I saw that, I thought, "Whoa, you know, we'll never see them again." And then when I got back to the village, I checked what time they had arrived, because we had people here that were sort of standing by, and they checked the time, and they got back here, and I think it was less than 30 minutes. Wow. And it was really beautiful to watch. But then one Christmas, you know, very quickly, weasels got into that A-frame up there and just killed all the pigeons in, you know, just minutes. Mm-hmm. And so after that, we decided that, you know, the weasels won. There was no way that we could really, you know, build anything that would keep them out when they were after, you know, pigeons like that. So that was the end of the pigeon project. But it was really, really started by request of Leo Bustead, because again, he was interested in seeing if maybe pigeons might be something that you know, could be worked with the People Pet Partnership. Well, there's a lot of stories that could keep going on and on. I guess it's 8:30. Yeah, I don't know if any of you have questions. We're going to have another session, I think, tomorrow night at 6:30, and continue on with some of these. But if you have some questions, it probably is okay to stay a little bit longer if things that you're curious about, or if you see me around, I don't do any hiking, so I'll be sitting around tomorrow. And you know, feel free to ask me questions, and but there's a lot of things. I've started writing some of these things down, and whether it'll ever get put together in a, you know, in a document that maybe could be available up here, I don't know. But there's just a lot of very interesting things that have happened over the years up here, and it's yeah.
I have a quick question. When was it that winter programming really began, and you brought guests up for the winter time?
Well, I mean, 1966 was the first winter we stayed open, and basically it was to, you know, test from our standpoint whether it was even possible to live up here in the winter time in this situation. And then even that winter, we had a few guests. We didn't really have any programming. We sort of kept the worship life going, but we didn't have any program as such. And then each year after that, you know, more and more guests, more and more staff came up. And so it was probably in maybe 68 or 69 that we really had some semblance of a program going. And then in 1970, I think, was the first time that we had a sabbatical people up here. And you know, of course, then when sabbatical people came, that meant that professors that were on some subject were available to help lead discussions and be more involved in that. But you know, so the program sort of built up. I mean, we did some programming on our own, it was really, you know, probably after 69 or 70 that more of a formal program got started. And even in 69, I think we had maybe 70 people here in the wintertime. And of course, we closed down the dining hall, and this was really the winter building. And there used to be, before the remodeling, there used to be a little kitchen where part of the library is. And, you know, so all the food service was down here, and we had set up removable tables in this area around the fireplace, and that's how 70 people lived in the wintertime, and it really worked out very well. And then, of course, we expanded Koinonia, and now what's called the, what's that called?
Creekside.
What?
Creekside?
Yeah, Creekside. That was the dining hall where we had basically, you know, permanent tables set up there for winter use and so forth. And
so snowmobiles were used to get all those people back?
Right, and yeah. And snowmobiles, and we actually built two sleds. And again, it was just, you know, not from any plans, but we just built sleds with actually wooden runners that had fiberglass on the runners. And one of them was an open sled. The other one was a sled that we built a box on. It was just a plywood box, and we had windows cut in the box with plastic over the windows. And that's what Jeff rode up. And I think the December 24th, when he was 6 days old, he was in that box behind the snowmobile. And that's how we got up here. So. But yeah, and we made multiple trips. You know, with if a larger group was coming in, you know, we just Oscar Getty was owner of the 3 acres down there, which is now the Lake Chelan Boat Club, and he had a little house that he lived in, and he was very gracious. You know, if we had twice as many people coming in as that we could haul up at any one time, he invited all of those people to stand in his little house with the airtight stove and until people got down there. And so, again, you know, even though he had no interest in a sense in the village, he was a wonderful neighbor, and the people always helped Holden, you know, to do things that we really didn't know how to do, you know, and we learned, and they were very good at helping us learn. So, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's fun
thank
to.
You. Thank you.